post-2011 June meeting. It's so nice to see so many people here today. We have quite a meeting, and we have quite a few things going on. Could I have your attention at all? Please rise to the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We have some new business members. We have E&S Cleaning Service of Brevard, Valley Crest Landscaping Maintenance, Dave's Tire and Auto Services, Hoog Electric, and Brevard Coastal Insurance. And while we're on Brevard Coastal Insurance, we might want to say thank you for the goodies that you guys are eating since they're sponsoring it today. Thank you. The next President's Forum meeting will be on July 9th. And I would like to let you all in on a few changes that are happening due to the hotel policy. There will be no going through their continental breakfast area. That exit and entrance will be blocked off from this point on, only coming in from the south side. No food or drinks are to be brought in here as per the health code. You can only have what is being supplied by the hotel. I guess that'll about cover it. We also have a guest here today who I'd like to introduce. For those of you who don't know her, she's from the District 3 County Commissioner, Ms. Trudy Infantani. Trudy, you'd like to say a few words?
Hi, thank you very much for letting me come today. I know I'm not your featured speaker, and it was nice enough for you guys to allow me to come speak for just a couple of minutes, so it's going to be a little bit fragmented and disorganized. I apologize. I'm more of a PowerPoint kind of person, but it's hard to do PowerPoints in 3 minutes or less. One of the biggest words that I'm trying to get out to the public is that your property taxes are probably going to rise again for Brevard County by about another 15%. Last year they rose about 15%, depending upon if you're in a municipality, a city, or otherwise. But I know our personal taxes increased by 13.5%. And this year we haven't decreased the budget, although I suggested we do so, and I'm a hands-on person. So if your spending is up here and your income comes down to here, you have two choices. Reduce this one down a little bit, we didn't, or raise this one up to match. Go figure how we're going to finance that. Yeah, through you all. So I'm encouraging people to write their county commissioners to tell them whether or not, in fact, their quality of life does increase with their tax bill, or perhaps it doesn't increase, such as mine does not increase as my tax bill rises, to let them know whether or not you want us to raise your taxes. But the main reason why I was here today was to talk about CRAs, and it's such a confusing topic, and there's a great deal of misinformation, and I brought way too few handouts to share when I finally figured out how to make it as a picture. But there is one misnomer. CRAs are called our Community Redevelopment Associations, or organizations, and we have them in Merritt Island. We have them in Melbourne, Palm Bay, all around Brevard County. There's about 19 of them. And what happens is we tell people all the tax money that's earned in that area. I'm going to make this really brief, so I'm leaving out a bunch of details. But the taxes that are earned in one area stay in that area. Okay, well, that's great. What about the taxes that are earned in this area? Well, they don't stay in that area. They help fund all of the general government, like the sheriff, supervisor of elections, tax collector, all of those services. But if all the funds that are earned in your area stay in your area, they don't go to fund that. Well, then what happens to everybody else surrounding you? Their taxes raise. So when people send out misinformation in emails, which I have a copy of, saying it won't cost you any more dollars, I do have a quick little handout, but again, I only printed about 25 of these, and it shows you if everybody in each district paid $21. It's the best analysis I could come up with at 4 o'clock in the morning. If each group in districts 1 through 5 pay $21 each, we'd have $105. Well, if only one group said, I'm only going to contribute $5, how much does everybody else have to contribute? That means each person would then have to contribute $25. But it doesn't mean the people that were only paying $5 only pay $5. They'll still pay $25 in taxes. Just 20 of that 25 will stay in their area, whereas the rest of us will subsidize general government. And that's the fastest version of CRAs that I could possibly do. There was a bunch of information, too little time, but I handed out some business cards, and again, I didn't bring enough of those because I've got to give you credit. For this many people to show up to learn and be able to talk with a world-renowned attorney on information about HOAs and community living, I take my hat off to you. You are a good group of people, so you deserve a round of applause.
Thank you, Trudy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Trudy, you'll be available after the meeting also if you want to network with her with any special questions. Today's program, as I'm sure you all are aware, is on the legislation of 2011, and our presenter, who definitely does not need much of an introduction, but I'll introduce him anyhow, the author of New Neighborhoods, which we also have a box full. They're $10 a piece if you want to pick them up on your way out. Anybody who didn't get them, they are excellent. And that is also some of the criteria that the board certification class was taken from. A lot of the information is in there. It's in plain English, so it's kind of easy to understand. At this point, I would like to introduce Mr. Gary Polyakov from the law firm of Becker & Polyakov. Gary?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy Father's Day to all the fathers. I'm heading back down to South Florida to enjoy Father's Day with my family and the special part, which we all enjoy, my yours and my grandchildren. During those days that my children were growing up, like most individuals, I was working, building a law firm. And then one day I woke up and they were all out of the house and had gone off to college. And so, of course, the fun today is being able to spend it with my grandchildren and helping out. If you look at the back of my car, this is the truth. It's parked outside. People look and they sort of laugh because my back seats were full of car seats for children and infants. I explained to them that I'm part of the carpool, and that's the fun pulling up to the school with all the young mothers picking up their kids, and here's Grandpa out there picking up his grandchildren. I really appreciate the opportunity. I've been coming up to the Space Coast communities now that include condominiums, cooperatives, and homeowner associations. At one time, it basically focused on condominium living for most of my career. And Space Coast communities associations, particularly in the early days under the leadership of Harry Charles, who, by the way, I appreciate it. Harry is, if you read New Neighborhoods, you'll notice in the back a very great quote from Harry Charles. And I will say one thing about New Neighborhoods. It's now approved by the Division of Florida Land Sales and Condominiums for board certification. So if any of your associations keep one in the library and you have a individual who is elected to the board, you know you're required to be certified. And it's just go to the library, read New Neighborhoods, and that gives you your certification, something you can do in a few hours and hopefully learn a little bit about it, about your responsibilities and shared ownership. But I appreciate the opportunity because several times over the course of the years, in order to help promote the passage of legislation, we brought community association leaders from across the state to Tallahassee. And one organization that we always knew would be there by the busload, and I don't mean that just figuratively, I mean filling real buses, going up to Tallahassee, and watching the legislative process and helping to pass important legislation, that's been the Space Coast Communities Association. So We greatly appreciate that. I currently, for my law firm, have State Senator Miguel de la Portilla is a member of my firm, and one of my former attorneys is now a senator in the United States Senate. That's Marco Rubio. So we're continuing to help educate some of the future leaders of both the Florida legislature and also the United States Senate. Although Marco's already been touted as a potential vice presidential candidate or maybe one day president, that would be nice. I am going to be talking to you today about what laws were passed during the 2011 legislative session that impacts condominiums, cooperatives, and homeowner associations. But there's a disclaimer I have to give you, and the disclaimer is that bill went to the governor on the 13th of June, and the governor has until June the 24th to either sign it into law, not sign it, in which case it would automatically become law, or to veto it. Now, there's really nothing controversial in the law. It's basically was what we call a glitch bill, a bill that was passed to correct some of the ambiguities and the confusions from some of the prior bills, but you never know. You might remember a few years ago there was a bill passed, and I thought it was really a good bill, and it had some really important provisions in it, and it was vetoed by then-Governor Crist at the last moment. And he vetoed it because it had a deferral of the obligation to retrofit buildings for hardwired fire sprinkler systems. He was convinced that there was apparently a rash of fires in communities, which I really never could find where they were occurring. But anyway, the governor at that time vetoed the bill, so after we had a session sort of like this talking about what the new law was going to do, then we had to put out a quick word say, by the way, forget everything you learned. The governor vetoed the bill. I don't think that's going to happen this year, but we're going to talk about it and we'll explain it, and hopefully comes the 24th that we'll hear that the governor did, in fact, sign the bill. And I also want to thank Roger Kasselbach. He's in the new age of technology. You know, I have an opportunity, particularly having written Neighborhoods, which was actually my third book. My other two books were written for lawyers, two-volume treaties, which is a desktop on condominium law, and the Florida CLE manual on shared ownership, which I did for the Florida Bar. When I go around the country speaking, which I do frequently across the country on this subject, in this age of technology, you email or you bring a little device that they plug into the computer and it automatically puts your program on the screen. But for years, if you came here early, you would see me running around trying to connect wires, connect the computer, make sure everything was balanced, everything was working. And I called Roger this year and I said, Roger, I said, I hope you're up to the times now. I don't have to come an hour earlier, do I, just to connect the PowerPoint. Roger said, no, I have it under control. So I thank Roger for getting the PowerPoint up, and hopefully everything will be running okay when I start my talk. I do want to mention a couple things before I talk about the legislation. And the first one is something we do need to concern ourselves about, and it is the hurricane season. And I have been up here during and after every single hurricane that has hit this area. And when I ride down the street, and I know off to the right, I know the name of building. There's a building down there that still is in the same condition it was in following the last hurricane, where it's basically closed up and has not been reoccupied. But there was a very important case decision, which I've written about in my column that's I believe, I don't know if it's run yet, and my column runs in Florida Today and a number of the newspapers in this area, and again, I thank you for your readership. Thousands of letters a year, I cannot respond to all of them, but I try to respond to those that I'm able to. I just randomly pick them out. The paper gives me a limited number of amount of space. The column is called New Neighborhoods, and it's now written with my son, Ryan, who is co-author of New Neighborhoods. And one of the cases that came out a few months back is so important that I want to mention it to you because it really impacts community associations. There was a article that just came out in the Community Association Institute magazine called Common Ground. And it's a great article, not because it happens to have a couple quotes from myself on it, but the name of the article is called Death of a Community. And what it talks about is what happened to the Naranja Lakes community, which was a 1,500-plus condominium located in Naranja Lakes, which is just about south of Homestead, Florida. And Hurricane Andrew passed right across Naranja Lakes, and I was on the property, standing on a downed tree the day after Hurricane Andrew passed by with a megaphone in my hand. Those were prefabricated single-story buildings, and I have to tell you, the day after the storm, there was nearly a building standing. The day before, it was a very vibrant community of thousands of individuals. It was built on leasehold land with a large recreational property, and Hurricane Andrew pretty much wiped it off the map, and there was a very limited amount of insurance. In fact, in those days, they operated under the theory that they carried an umbrella policy. They were multiple buildings of condominiums, and they figured if one building was damaged or burned down, or two or three buildings, their $25 million of insurance would take care of it. But when Hurricane Andrew passed by there, it was self-evident that $25 million would not rebuild but very little of the community, and the mortgages on the units certainly would eat that up very quickly. The insurance company wrote a check to the association, threw up their hands, and that community later was razed. I mean by razed, it was totally bulldozed down, doesn't exist anymore, and that's what the article is about. And one thing that's very important, even though we've been blessed and for the last 5 years, we haven't had a storm really come through here since Hurricane Wilma. We've all watched the news. We've seen the impact of nature. We've seen what tsunamis do, which is really the equivalency of a storm surge. I've seen communities wiped off the map in the panhandle of Florida from storm surges. We've seen what tornado can do. Tornadic activity is part of hurricanes. In fact, a lot of the Hurricane Andrew were from tornadoes that were part of that storm. And I've written, and it's online, articles on disaster preparedness. And it's the one thing that I will continue to harp on, that every one of you should make certain that your community has a disaster plan in place, a disaster coordinator, and we have enacted legislation now, which I'm not covering today, but take the time to look at it, that's part of the Florida Condominium Act that gives boards immense powers following storms to be able to act even if they don't have a full board in place, including borrowing money, including requiring mandatory evacuation where the local authorities have issued evacuation orders, including prohibiting and precluding individuals from returning to the community. Under the Florida Condominium Act as it exists today, boards have the authority without the permission of unit owners to enter units following storms and to remove all wet portions of the unit to preclude the growth of mold in units. And that includes removal of carpeting, removal of furniture, removal of drywall. It's what we call mitigation of damages through drying out and shoring up of the property. Do take the time, not after a storm hits. Take the time now to go to Chapter 718, turn to the section on emergency board powers, and so you will get a better understanding of exactly what it is you need to do if a storm hits this area. The other thing, which is very important, and I mentioned this in my articles, is photographic evidence of what the community looks like, not after the storm, but today. You should have a video recording of the entirety of your community. You should have a photograph. It should be on a disc. It should not be stored on your property. Send it to a relative up north. Tell them, hold on to this. Make sure you have a complete set of the as-built drawings of your communities. They become very critical in the aftermath of a storm. I've had communities go in and start bulldozing down buildings, and they end up cutting the main power lines into the community because they ended up being laid in areas that weren't shown on the plans. You don't want that happening. But the other thing I want to talk to you about is the decision out of a federal court in the Buckley case. Here's a community that went into court following Hurricane Wilma. They attained a judgment of close to $25 million for casualty repairs, and the federal court reduced that judgment down to approximately $9 million. Why did they reduce the judgment? Because most of the judgment was based upon what is called RVC, or RCV. You got insurance people here, you'll correct me as to which one it is. It's replacement cost value. And the reason, so you say, well, why did they reduce it? Well, the other aspect of insurance is actual cost of replacement that you're insured for, the cash value of replacement. The condominium act says you have to insure a building for the cost of replacement. That's law. You have to insure for the cost of replacement. But if you insure the building for cost of replacement, when the insurance company comes out and they evaluate the damages, what are they going to do first? They're going to do the cash value on the day the storm hit, which means that includes depreciation. So there's not adequate money under any condition. Plus, you all also have the components of buildings that are uninsurable, such as your, in most cases, paint, your landscaping, even some of your pool decks, that you need to maintain a reserve, or you're going to end for certain have special assessments. So the replacement cost of the building is more than your cash value of the building. Does anybody here, did they read Buckley? Do they know why is it that the federal court knocked $19 million off of a $25 million verdict? Or it was a little less than that because they ended up with about $9 million in actual. So about $10 million of the $25 million was knocked off. Does anyone here have any idea? I know you got some insurance experts here because you're following these. Because what is insurance? It's a manner of mitigation of damages. But what is that document that you get when you buy your insurance? Someone said it's a contract. It's a contract. It's an agreement. And do you know what those policies say? 99% of them? They all say the same thing. They say to apply for monetary recovery for replacement cost value, you must first do the repairs. I can't tell you how many associations I've dealt with over the years that say, well, We don't have the money. We're going to have to wait until the insurance company settles with us before we repair our buildings. If your contract, which I can almost guarantee you it says, that you cannot recover for replacement value until you have made the repairs, you will not be able to file a claim under your insurance policy. And that's what happened to the Buckley Towers condominium. There's a second component of that that's not covered unless you first make the repairs. And insurance, we refer to it several different terms. I call it law and ordinance coverage. Every one of you in this room, including me, you better darn make sure that you have as a rider on your insurance policy law and ordinance coverage. It's not automatic, it's a rider. You know what that is? That says at the time you make your repairs, if the code has changed to the point that you now have to raise the level of the building or put in hurricane windows, you're not going to get coverage unless you have law and ordinance coverage. That's the coverage you have for upgrades of the codes that have taken place since your building was built. Guess what? If you have, which is the law, more than 50% damage to a building and you're on a coastal area and the elevations have changed and you have to tear the entire building down, even if only 50% of it was damaged, even the cost of removing the debris from the part of the building that wasn't damaged is not covered by insurance unless you have law and ordinance coverage. So under the Buckley decision, not only did they lose the money for the cost of meeting current code requirements, they also lost because the law and ordinance to upgrade because they didn't spend the money ahead of time to make the repairs. Please don't make that mistake. Now, your next question comes, these are hard times. I know that as well as anyone. I spend 60% of every day dealing with the crisis we're in across the state with over 500,000 homes in foreclosures, with large communities throughout the state that have delinquencies that are running as high as 30, 40%. And I know that a lot of those communities are not buying insurance. They're certainly not buying flood insurance, which is exorbitant in cost currently. They're taking risks which are dangerous to be taken, but I understand it. And they're also not making repairs to buildings that should be repaired because there's no money. But that doesn't excuse the obligation under the contract. And there are three options for getting that money to make those repairs. One is special assessment. Second is a commercial line from the bank you do business with, and that should be established now, not after a storm. The third, and one I highly recommend, is Small Business Administration loans. Very low interest rates. We were able to secure dozens of loans from the SBA following the hurricanes to rebuild communities. So it's a third option. So you have reserves, you have commercial loans, you have special assessments, and you have SBA loans. So let's be a word to the wise. We're all going to hope that we're not hit this year by a storm, and we'll continue to be blessed in avoiding these storms, but they're a natural incident of nature. And a statistic I showed the other day said that we're long overdue, that the average of storms hits Florida at least once every 5 years, and we're already in our fifth year. So one thing we want to make sure of is let's not have, I don't want to be back up here next year talking about the death of a community on the Space Coast because they didn't heed the advice I'm giving you and making sure that you're ready in the event there is a catastrophic event that takes place up here. One other thing, and I'm not going to spend much time talking about it right now, but in the following the legislation, and I could do this because there wasn't a whole lot of legislation, so it's not going to take 2 hours to talk about the legislation. Again, they were glitches that were corrected. Is I spend, I said 60% of time dealing with foreclosures, collections, the financial crisis. I probably spend 30% of my time dealing with the vast volume of litigation that is being filed under the Fair Housing Law against community associations for not complying with the requirement that communities make reasonable accommodations and modifications in their rules and regulations for handicapped individuals. And the most prevalent of the litigation that I'm seeing is where associations are being sued for not allowing handicapped individuals to make modifications of the premises at their expense so that they can enjoy full use and benefit of the property. Keep in mind, under law, once those modifications are made, the association cannot compel the owner who pays to make the modifications to remove them. So even if they move from the community, they remain part and parcel of the community. There's nothing that says you can't remove it once a person moves out, but you cannot require the person who makes modification. I'm talking about everything from lifts being put into building to pavements to hand railing. Those are things. The second part, the part where most of the litigation is coming in, does anyone know, is in what? Actually, in two areas, and they both begin with P. Parking and pets. Parking and pets. Even if yours is a no-pet building, if an individual has a service animal. I'm deliberately not using the word trained service animal. The word trained is no longer a part of the law. ABC did a news bit last week on one of the most unique service animals I've seen. And I've dealt with miniature horses and monkeys and obviously dogs, even pigs. What was the one that was on TV about 2 weeks ago? Did anyone see it? A service rat. It's for real. Go to Google, put in service rat. This rat sat on the shoulder of an individual with a handicap, and I don't know that I quite understood exactly what it was doing. But it was trained to do something relative to their condition. The second type of animal, if it's a service animal, it's a no-brainer. You're not going to be able to preclude that animal from your community. But the one where most of the litigation is emotional support animals. Emotional support animals do not apply under the Americans with Disability Act. It does apply under the Fair Housing Act. But you must show a nexus between the animal and the issue that needs to be ameliorated.
Projector working
okay? Oh, I haven't tried the projector yet.
Oh, okay.
This isn't covered on the projector, so I wanted to cover these things and make sure. This is where I'm seeing all the litigation, so I wanted to talk about this first, Roger, even though it wasn't on the program. He who holds the mic gets to talk about what they want, right? The commissioner will tell you that. Hopefully you agree that that's important to understand, because this is, I'm trying to keep you out of trouble. And this is where I'm seeing the problems. I've been doing this for 40 years and had the pleasure of counseling over those years, probably 10,000 associations, and my firm currently works with over 4,500 communities. There's 40,000 associations in Florida today. In the United States today, according to the Community Association Institute, there are 300,000 community associations, mandatory membership associations. There are over 54 million individuals who live in communities governed by mandatory membership associations. And 2 million individuals volunteer each year to serve on the boards of governors of these associations. So you're in good company if you're serving on boards or if you're living in a community. That's 1 in 20 people in this country now live in a community governed by a mandatory membership association that has taken over a lot of the responsibility that once was and services that once were provided by strapped governments that are under financial difficulty. Everything from waste management to security to recreational. And there is a clear analogy there. The taxation for the assessments and dealing with the issues that we're talking about. Okay, so now let's take a moment and see, what did the legislature do for us or do to us this year? Again, this is primarily a glitch bill. And let me see if I have the right button here, Roger. Roger, which one is the up or down one on here? Oh, I guess I got to go. There we go. There we go. Okay, now you might look at your outline. This part of the outline that I'm going to talk to you about up here is not in your outline. Actually, it was invisible. It was that invisible ink. I wanted to test your eyesight for you. I tell you why I added this. The bulk of this presentation was done on a webinar by my firm for boards on the upcoming legislative changes. And I started thinking about it, and I said, there's something that no one talks about that is equally important, and that is we spend all this time talking about all these legislative changes. Do they apply? We assume every year you have speakers that walk in here and they tell you all about these legislative changes. How many times did the legislature change? It's easy. Count the number of editions of my good friend Pete Dunbar's book. Good book. But every time they change a word in the statute, it comes out with the next edition. I can promise you New Neighborhoods doesn't have next editions. It was written in a way that isn't dependent upon legislative changes. If you can read the top line there, it's so important. The United States and Florida Constitution has a provision in it. It says no state... I want to underline the word state. I want to put it in capitals for you. No state can pass a law that impairs a contract right. The federal government can. Let's assume you have an agreement with some foreign country to sell them grain. And the federal government comes along and puts an embargo on selling grain to that country. Totally legal. Or armament. But what if you have a contract with me and the legislature decides we don't like that type of a contract arrangement, or we want to put certain provisos in there? It's quite possible that the law that is passed is only going to apply prospectively to contracts entered into after the date the law was passed. So since 1963, when the original condominium act was passed in this state, there have been hundreds, if not a thousand, changes to the Condominium Cooperative and the Homeowner Association Act. And we blindly say, hey, we got to run our condominiums in accordance with this new law. That's not true. It depends. And there were two cases decided in the last, since January, that really do emphasize this point. And so before I talk to you about the legislative changes that did pass, I think you need to understand this. And you need to ask the question, do we have to comply with this law? If it's something that your community doesn't feel is necessary, proper, or important to your community. So you've seen the comment that's right out of the Constitution of the United States. I can tell you it's the same words are in the Florida Constitution. It tells you in the second A part there that a declaration of condominium, a declaration of covenants, conditions, and restrictions is a contract. The landmark case in Florida is Pomponio versus Claridge. Okay? And it laid down an important principle. If the change in the law, and I'm going to use a term that we use, is substantive. That's an impairment, and it doesn't apply. If it's remedial or procedural or addresses a penal type of problem, then it does apply. So we've all accepted without really questioning it, this law that now says, and by the way, it will come into effect probably next year. Look for legislation for homeowner associations, and I'm talking about the way you elect your directors with a ballot and an envelope. Your documents might have a totally different procedure for nomination and election of your directors. But the state commission, the Advisory Council and the State Study Commission, of which I served as a member of, and then later served as chair of the State Advisory Council. I used to go to meetings of condominiums and homeowner associations. You'd never see a crowd like this at a meeting. You'd walk into the room, there'd be two people there. You remember those days? And there'd be two people, and beside each one would be large stacks of paper. What were the proxies? No one went to meetings. They all voted by proxy. And we said this isn't the right way to be running these associations. There should be more active participation of the members. True story, before the change of the law, there was a situation where a group was put up a slate of candidates to run to recall the board. It wasn't a recall, it was a new election. I say this is one of the stories about the ins and outs of condominium living. When there's one group in power, there's always another group that wants to get them out of power. So the individual who was running the campaign with his slate did a beautiful marketing job, had a slate of candidates, had the envelopes sent to a post office box, And about a few days before the election, the individual goes down to the post office and asks for his mail. Everyone told him, you know, you got my vote. You got my vote. This guy was competent. He would be able to recall the board. The postman comes back out and he says, there's nothing in your box. He said, what do you mean there's nothing in my box? I know people told me they sent back their proxy to me. Today you can't use those proxies, as you know, but in those days you could. And the postman came back up and he had one of these slips of paper in his hand. And he says, is this your signature? And the guy said, no, that's not my signature. He said, well, someone came down here and they forwarded all your mail to somewhere in Alaska. I don't think that was the intent of the law, so as a member of the study commission, I traveled all over the state of Florida, and we wrote the law, this law today, that says in order to elect members to the board, and you'll see it in HOAs next year, at least the legislation introduced, you have to have pre-qualification, that is, at least 40 days before the election, individuals who want to run for the board have to turn their names in. And in a minute, I'll tell you that's one of the glitches that's been passed this year. And you... So does that apply? Is that a substantive change in the law? If your documents had set up a totally different procedure? I don't know. No one's ever ruled on it. We've all just accepted as fact that that was a remedial change of how you elect directors. But was it? And I say was it because there was a case that just came out. And in this case, it was a mixed-use condominium, mixed-use meaning it was made up of commercial and residential units. And the law changed to say if a majority of the units in the community consist of residential units, then the residential owners are entitled to elect a majority of the members of the board. Their document said that the commercial unit owners had a weighted vote and therefore could elect a majority of the members of the board. The Florida Court, Supreme Court of the state of Florida, decided, you see it says 211WL, you know what that means? That means it was just recently decided. It hasn't even been given one of those second district, third district, Florida Supreme Court numbers because it's so current, it's only been reported in the Wall Leakley. The court voided the amendment. They didn't void the amendment in the statute. They said that amendment doesn't apply to your condominium because it's a substantive change to your contractual right. So I ponder, but I can't answer the question, are we obligated to follow this envelope in the envelope? Here you have one case that's saying, no, you do not. But let me give you a counter provision. This was decided also this year, I think around March, Tahiti Beach. Here the board, by rule, passed a rule. They had a beef against an owner. They had a provision in their documents that said that had to build your home if you bought a lot within a defined period of time. I think it was 24 months. And this individual was probably 3 or 4 years and still had never built a house. So they passed a rule saying if you were in violation of the covenants that you'd be fined $10,000 for the violation. And each continuing violation was another $10,000. By the time this matter reached court, this unit owner, for not building his home, was being fined $285,000. The court said, the statute, what statute am I talking about? The HOA Act. What does the HOA Act say? It says you can only fine $100 up to an aggregate of $1,000. Here it was a $285,000 fine. The court said the legislation's remedial. And it controls. And you cannot fine that individual. Now, one of the things that the HOA Act still has that the Condominium Act doesn't have is if your documents permit fines greater than $1,000, you're still allowed to fine for more than $1,000. And you can do one other thing that you cannot do in a condominium, and what is that? Who's that? Raise your hand. Correct. You can lien in an HOA. You cannot lien for a fine in a condominium or a cooperative. So are you confused? Because you should be. I'm a law professor and I'm confused by this. You got the Constitution of the United States in Florida. You have two cases both decided this year. Each went a different direction as to whether or not the legislative change would apply. And as I talk about these changes that took effect or will take effect if the governor doesn't veto them, I want you to be thinking, and the reason I'm doing this, I want you to think about every one of those changes and say, is it substantive, impairment of contract, or is it remedial, procedural, it's going to apply to my community? You don't have to accept as gospel when they pass legislative changes that it applies to your community. You can meet as a community, as a board, and say, is this something that we want for sure to govern our community? If not, go back and make sure you discuss with your attorney these cases. If you're not confused enough, I have to show you two additional things. Unbelievable. I'm going to read you. This is unbelievable. One court said, and I'm going to read this, if courts of this state were to apply the law in effect when the declaration of condominium was recorded and in order to all subsequent amendments to the said law, it would result in a morass of legal entanglements where no holding in one condominium case could be precedent for any except those created in the same year. This could not possibly be the intent of the legislature or the courts of this state. This is one of those aberrations. Decision of the 4th District Court of Appeal. Are you in the 4th District? What district is the Space Coast? I'm not sure. I know it goes in Palm Beach. Don't know if it comes up this far. 1988, you have this case saying, well, every amendment applies. I'm not going to take the time to go back and look at the date the declaration was filed and do this analysis. You probably had a lazy court that didn't want to deal with Pomponio, which is this Supreme Court decision of this state. And there's one other exception. A decision that was argued by my firm successfully and is the one true exception to everything that I've talked to you about. Not because we won the case, but because you'll see in a minute why it is the exception. And it's a case called Kaufman v. Scheer. Have you heard lawyers or others talk about the Kaufman decision? Why is Kaufman different from everything I've talked about? Because the Kaufman document contract had a provision in the contract that said the Condominium Act, as same may be amended from time to time, is hereby expressly incorporated into and shall control the operation of this condominium. So it is not an impairment because it is merely an interpretation of the contract. And the contract provided that all amendments to the Condominium Act shall apply and govern that condominium. You have the option of amending your condominium documents, your homeowner association documents, to add Kaufman language. But you get the good with the bad. And I tell people, be cautious if you do it blanketly over your entire document. Because you may like having the option of controlling the number of people that can live in a one-bedroom, two-bedroom unit, or pets or no pets, or how often you can lease or not lease your units. And you know, recently the Condominium Act was amended to caused by a single person to preclude associations from borrowing leasing of units. So if you wanted to preclude transient use of your units and you put in Kaufman language, then automatically you're incorporating, you're embodying into your contract those legislative changes. Okay? So I don't know if you've ever had this discussion before, but it's a discussion that every condominium really ought to have. And that's why I decided when I was coming up here today to add it to that which was the outline presentation. And by the way, you can see the bill was introduced by Representative Morales. It's House Bill 1195. So when we're looking for whether the governor vetoes or an acts upon it. Again, I know I've said it, but I want you to understand. 99% of what's in the law this year was strictly to clarify ambiguities of last year's law, where they wrote it in a hurry, and people couldn't understand what it said, so it's called a glitch bill. There's one thing that's not in the glitch bill that I'm going to mention to you first, because it's not even in the slides, so make a note of this. There's a law now in effect, and by the way, if the glitch bill passes, it will be effective July 1st of this year. There is a new law. Please listen to this. It is now prohibited in the state of Florida for you to impede service of process by a process server. You may not advise a person in your community that there's a process server sitting downstairs waiting to serve them with papers. You can certainly ask the person to show proof of identification. But you can't then call upstairs and say, Charlie, go out the back window. Okay? It's now the law of this state. If a unit owner elects to receive notices of the meetings by email or facsimile, that's part of the public record. But if they retract it, which they can, and you happen to have that information as part of their personnel file, it is not part of the public records, and you may not disclose that information to any other unit owner who otherwise has a right of access to information concerning the owners and their numbers or addresses that are part of the official records of the association. So that's one change. the contracts, personnel records, are not part of the records viewable by unit owners. The contract for personnel, including the personnel of management companies, is not part of the official records viewable by the unit owners. To the best of my knowledge, and I'm still confused about this, you're entitled to know the compensation of an individual. But if an individual is working for a management company, I don't know how you're going to have control over or access to that information anyway. But the personnel records has now been defined, and it does not allow that as one of the exempted records. And if someone wants to see the contract, which they can see, you'd have to redact out any of the personal information, including, I said you can see the compensation. That's somewhat unclear to me as to whether you can see their actual pay or only the collective pay of the individuals, and I'll try to clarify that at a later time. If we have time later on, I'm going to go through with you as to what records are accepted. I wrote at the top if it applies to condominiums and also if it applies to HOAs or cooperatives. This one is one for condominiums. It's in your outline. Condominium boards can meet in closed session without the lawyer being present. What a horrible law. How can I make money? Closed meeting. There's a debate, you know, as one of my other hats, I mentioned to you, I served 10 years as a city attorney. And when municipalities or governments meet in closed session, and there's a very limited exception to the Sunshine Law, they have to post notice that the meeting will take place, they gather, they announce they're going into closed session. They have to have a reporter to keep the records, and when the matter for which the closed session was held is over with, then the record becomes part of the public records. It's unclear here whether or not you need to post a notice of a board meeting that will be a meeting in closed session to talk about personnel matters. But it is now permitted. The board can also meet in closed session, but the attorney must be present to talk about pending or threatened litigation. The only two exceptions. Boards cannot meet. How many times people ask me this? There's no such thing as a, what is the term they call it? A
workshop
meeting. There's no such thing as a workshop meeting. If a quorum of the board is present, even at a social event, and they're sitting around talking about matters that may reasonably come before the board, that is a board meeting. If they're talking about their golf game, that's fine. It's not a board meeting, and more than a quorum can sit around and chat and talk and socialize or go out to dinner. But they cannot do so if they have a quorum of the board present. Sorry, the law in the homeowner association setting, as far as the closed meetings. I spoke to a reporter from the St. Petersburg Time yesterday for over an hour and a half, talking about a situation we're experiencing all over the state. Whenever there appears to be an opportunity to take advantage of a crisis type of situation, there are those who vulture on that condition. And what's happening is we all know that the mortgagees are not foreclosing, sometimes for a considerable period of time, on their units. And the reason they're not foreclosing is for several reasons. Number one, they may go to judgment, but they don't go to courthouse sale. They recognize that if they own the unit, what happens? They're a unit owner. And if that hurricane comes through and there's a cash shortfall, or if there's a building special assessment to do retrofitting or balcony restoration or put a new roof on the building, they have to pay for it. They're in the business. There was a case recently where a bank, after going in and looking at a unit that they had in foreclosure, extinguished the mortgage, told the association, it's yours, you can have it. It was totally uninhabitable. The unit owners, and we've seen a lot of these, when they vacated the unit, which was upside down, the mortgage, they probably hadn't paid in 2 years. I guess they felt they were owed something. They stripped the unit down of almost everything in the unit. The appliances, the fixtures, the electrical, they pulled the wires, the cabinetry. The bank said it will cost us more to restore this unit into habitability than the value of the mortgage. Short sales I've talked about. A lot of times you get these unit owners and they have a unit. It's upside. It's underwater. They have a mortgage of $300,000. The unit at one time was worth $500,000. Now the unit is down to about $150,000, $200,000. Someone comes along and says, I'll give you $150,000 for this unit. The unit owner calls the bank. The bank says, fine. They write the check. They give the check to the bank, $150,000. The unit owner moves out of town. They feel relieved, right? Guess what? They still own the bank $150,000. The buyer doesn't owe the bank any money. The seller on a short sale, unless the bank agrees to extinguish the obligation, has 5 years to bring a separate legal action. It's not part of the foreclosure to obtain what is called a deficiency judgment. And there's a whole cottage industry that's growing up buying these bundled deficiency judgments. They can go after these individuals up to, I think it's up to 15 years or maybe 12 years. So a guy goes back, he starts his life over, he's now successful, gets a knock on the door. You know that unit you walked away from? You still owe the bank $150,000. We bought it from the bank. This is... You'll see a lot of these. They're being bundled. They're being sold. So what's the other cottage industry that's built up? Companies have opened up all over the state, and they're going to public sale of association lien foreclosures and or the unit owner, and they're buying the units for nominal amount of money, and they're renting them out. They don't go through the screening process. Spend a lot of time with people talking to me about the individuals that move in. Pets and no-pet communities. Time-sharing of residential units. Seasonal rentals. At least in these cases, these individuals actually get the deed to the unit. The worst situation are where the individuals go in with a locksmith, change locks of abandoned units, put them on Craigslist or one of the other lists, rent them out for the season, and they don't even own the units. These are honest to God. This is happening all over the state. What I don't understand is this. I've yet to have a single bank, which they have a right under their mortgage, get a receiver appointed to collect those rents. So why doesn't the association do this? Why are they allowing these outsiders to come in and rent these units? The associations could be renting them out and getting some cash flow in. The only reason would be if the units are so uninhabitable that the investment into the units to make them habitable would be so great that as far as the value. Well, these individuals are obviously finding it to be a value, and they're buying thousands of these units. I've told you once, I'll repeat it again. Currently, in this state, there are 500,000 units in foreclosure. And they're growing. We don't have enough courts. We don't have enough judges. We don't have enough personnel. And banks are skittish about foreclosing for another reason, because they're being slammed by the federal government. And they're being slammed by this whole group of lawyers who have sprung up, who are challenging the validity of the mortgages to start with, saying that the I's weren't dotted, the T's weren't crossed, and the paperwork was fabricated. I have to be honest with you, I have a little problem with that, because I've come from a different upbringing. And if I borrow money from somebody, I don't need a piece of paper to say I should pay it back. I don't care if there's a little flaw in it. If I borrowed it, I'm paying it back. That's just the way I feel about it. There are a lot of people who are living assessment-free and mortgage-free in units, and it's really impacting negatively the entire shared ownership living. So we now have, so the state can't really address this problem, because all the court cases where we've brought to compel banks to expedite the foreclosure process, or to allow associations, you've seen associations attempt what they call to move for summary judgment, not on their assessment, but on the banks. And the courts have struck in all those, saying it's their mortgage and they decide how they're going to deal with it. So all we can do is what we did. We passed a law that says that if you have unit owners who are not paying their assessment, this is condominium and homeowners and cooperatives, you can deny them and their tenants the right to use the amenities. Can you keep them from using their font to come in through the owner's access point? No one knows for sure, but a lot of pundits say yes. Tell them, disconnect their font, tell them to go into the line with the visitors. No court's ruled on this yet. Can you cut off their utilities? No. Specifically in the law, it says you cannot cut off the utilities. Though I have known unit owners who aren't paying their electric bill that sit in their units with candles. You can cut off the cable, although there was a bill that was passed, that was introduced this year, that never made it through specifically saying that, but everyone believes you can cut off the cable. But in truth, the cable companies will generally not cut off the cable. Why? Because most cable companies today are bundling services. So it's not just cable, it's high-speed internet, it's telephones, and it's very difficult to be able to do so. By the way, while I'm thinking about it, we'll pass it when I come through it, we've now enacted an amendment into the HOA law, the same as the condominium law, saying that an association can enter into an agreement for bulk cable and bundled services. For years, I didn't know the answer to the question, can a homeowner association require mandatory cable? We used to argue as part of its general provision of services, yes. Now there's a law. The law now says homeowner associations can enter into an agreement. And just like in a condominium, the homeowners have a right at the first meeting following the entering into that contract to vote to cancel it. No one ever does. No one even knows the law says that. But you can enter into it in condos, co-ops, and HOAs, bundled services. The key here, and I'm not going to read it because of time, but it's in the act. It was unclear, and one of the things that was changed in this year's law, it was unclear whether the money you could collect from the tenant. So we also amended, now you can suspend the use rights. And I'll come back and clarify that in a minute. You can also collect the rent from a tenant who's renting the unit. And that law said for future obligations. That's been changed. The new law says you can collect rent for all monetary obligations owed to the association. But you must send notice to the tenant using the form in the statute. Don't make up your letter, your own letter. Dear tenant, you got a deadbeat landlord. He's an idiot. Pay us instead. You must use the form. It's in the statute. Okay? You'll find it in... I'll give you the section. I have a copy here. I would read it, but I don't want to run out of time. Roger, take this. This is the statutory language, and maybe put it on your website. Maybe you just cut this part out. Okay? It's this. This is the statutory language.
Okay.
All right, we'll get it on the Space Coast Communities Association website. Whenever the statute says this is what you should say, I tell my students, don't be creative. Take the statutory language, use that in your letter, put your association name, send that to the tenant, tell them the money has to go to them. And guess what? And this is a good question. The statute also says that the association and board is immunized from liability from the landlord. Is that a substantive change to a contract? I don't know. But there was another case just decided last week that said that a lot of cases coming out now in this field, but not because of this. Another case just came out that said that the association owes a duty to immunize the members of the board of directors. So even if you do this and the board sued, if you have the provision in the bylaws, which you should have, that boards who serve, volunteers, are granted immunity, that is, they're given protection from the association, you should have directors and officers' liability coverage, and or the association still needs to protect them from the suit. What I just told you is absolutely what the statute says about the immunity. But again, this is brand new law. Assuming it's signed, can I tell you what a court will say if and when challenged? And that says it down there about the immunity. This is the certification. You can read your conduct documents. You can go to a certification course. You can read new neighborhoods. One of our attorneys was up here at one of your recent meetings, Lance Klaus. Great guy. He came up here to do a board certification class. You don't have to get these certifications every year. Once certified, you're certified as long as you have a continual service on the board. Not good for book sales, but it's good law. Okay, you got that now? How about that? That's important. It used to be that every year, you know, you got elected, you got to keep getting certified, no more. As long as you're serving continuously. If there was a gap in service, even for a month, you have to get recertified. When do you have to get certified? 1 year before you're elected or 90 days after the election? Okay? If you're not certified, you're automatically disqualified and off the board. So please make sure you don't allow that to happen. Yes, it applies to homeowners associations as well, I'm quite sure. Now here's an interesting thing about those suspension of use rights. The HOA law before legislation passed in 2010, gave the association the right to suspend use rights of members under their alternative to fining. But when they amended the law to provide the right to suspend use rights for being delinquent and paying their assessments, it says if you're more than 90 days and paying your assessments, then you could suspend use right. The drafter of the law inadvertently struck the provision that said that the association could suspend use rights for even owners who are current if they're violating the rules and regulations. That has been corrected now. See, it says condos, co-ops, HOA, this applies to all three. Does the right to suspend and fine need to be in your documents? No, because it's in the statute now. And we can argue that it's a remedial provision. You can suspend for a reasonable period of time the use rights of the amenities. You do not need to have a meeting, due process, equal protection, before you levy a suspension for non-payment of assessments. One other thing about qualifying for the board. You have to be eligible for the board on the date. Write this down. Make sure you understand this. You have to be eligible for the board on the date you submit your application, which is 40 days prior to the election. So if you have a unit owner who's more than 40 days late, more than, let's say, 90 days late in paying their assessments, and they usually say, well, wait and see if I'm elected, whether I pay. No longer. That unit owner has to be current on the day that he files for election. You have to be out. So it's a convicted felon whose rights haven't been restored, not eligible to serve on the board. If you're delinquent for more than 90 days, you're not eligible to serve on the board. You have to be eligible on the date of qualification. Here's another one which is kind of interesting. What if you have individuals who have been suspended from their voting rights is suspended? Do they count towards a quorum? The answer is no, not under the new law. So if you have a community of 50 owners and five of them are suspended for non-payment of assessment, the number for quorum determination is 45, not the 50. That's an important change there. The meeting at which the board suspends the individual for non-payment of assessment is a board meeting. It must be noticed open to the owners. Speaking about notice and open to owners, let's talk a minute about HOAs. If you're in a condominium, it's been the law for years that you have to post an agenda, and owners have a right to be at the meeting, but they never had a right to speak at the meeting. They had to sign a petition to do that. That's changed. Now an association, HOA, must post an agenda, although it doesn't really say that. We assume that. The law does not say they have to have an agenda, but it says that the unit owners have a right to speak at HOA meetings. They don't have to sign petitions to be able to do so. But how can you know what you're going to speak to unless there's an agenda posted? And most associations do post agendas, even though that's another mistake in the law that's going to need to be corrected. If all members of the board's term expire at the annual meeting, condominium, no one else qualifies to run for the board, those board members' terms continue.
With no election.
No election. Now here's a change in the law from what the division has previously said. Division has, by arbitration decision, on several occasions said term limits are prohibited. They've reversed that. They say, construing the language of the law now, that if the documents allow for term limits, then you can have term limits that say you can only serve one or two continuous terms. Keep in mind, in a condominium, you can only have staggered election if your documents provide for it for the, I think it's 2 years. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this one. This is going to be really, really strange. This is really strange. They've now got a law that says that you can partially terminate a condominium. You have a casualty, you don't want to rebuild the entire condominium, so you vote by the 80% to not terminate the entirety of the condominium. Terminate is where you extinguish the condominium regime, becomes a property of tenancy in common, you sell off the property, you divide up the proceeds. I don't know whose bill this is, but now they have a law that says you can partially terminate, which means that they can, let's assume you have three buildings and they decide, and let's assume there are four building condominium. And one building, through a hurricane or a fire, burns down, and they just don't have the money, they don't want to rebuild it. Under this new law, they could basically say we're terminating the fourth building and those individuals are no longer unit owners. I don't know how this is going to work. It doesn't make any sense to me, but that's what the law says. So I can't say a lot about it because it's just been put into the statute and I don't know what the intent of the drafter is of this. This is just a provision. Do we have any cooperatives in the room? Any cooperatives? Okay, this is one that precludes liens in a certain situation in a cooperative. HOAs, that's the bulk TV provision we talked about. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. It's a large part of the amendments to the bill. We passed a bill a couple years ago for the benefit of developers to try to unload this large stock of unsold condo units. It's called the, I forget the exact language, but it was a bill designed with the sunset of 2 years to say that a bulk buyer of units would not be defined as being a developer under the law and thus not would not be subject to the warranties, paying of shortfalls and assessments. Being sued, the idea was we would get allow the vulture funds or individuals with large stocks of cash to buy up all these unsold units and these buildings that were built where there wasn't a market because we felt it was more important to get some buyers into the units that can infuse cash into the association coffers. There's some efforts to extend this law. We're not really in favor of extending it. It was done as a favor for a limited period of time, and we don't want it to be abused by allowing individuals to come in. And really what we're concerned about is someone comes into, and if you, I don't know if you have them up in your area. There are areas that I travel through where you see these partially built buildings. Construction had stopped in the midst of the economic downturn. You see the concrete buildings, but are not finished. So someone buys the building, they go and they finish it up, and I think if they finish it up and there are deficiencies in the building, that they should be held responsible for the construction defects of those buildings. But there is an effort to expand that. That's the one I told you, HOAs. You can speak to any item now. This one, typical, this is classic glitch bill. You had one part of a bill last year that said buildings less than 4 stories in height. Another one said buildings referenced 1 or 2 stories did not have to retrofit for hardwire sprinkler systems. That's now been changed to conform that any building that is that are less than 4 stories in height with exterior corridors providing a means of ingress is exempt from installing a manual fire system. Okay? So if you're less than 4 stories, that's strictly to correct a conflict in the law. If it's less than 4 stories, you don't have to install a hardwired fire sprinkler system. Let's clarify the hurricane protection. I'm mindful of the old saying that the mind can only endure what the mind can only absorb what the seat can endure. So we'll get through soon, and then we'll stretch and answer a few questions. By the way, you're only sitting as long as my class it normally sits as it is. The class goes for nearly 2 hours, twice a week. You know something? I teach at Nova Southeastern, and there's a lot of individuals who go back to school. And but even if they're younger, I'm not. I have to stand up there talking. what this talks about here is that if an association has the responsibility to maintain the windows of the units, the association, without a vote of the members, can elect to install our hurricane windows or other types, I use words now, other types of code-compliant safety windows, including film, including laminated glass, including hurricane glass, including shutters, okay, and no vote of the owners is required. If the unit owners are required to do the maintenance of the windows, then by a majority vote of the unit owners, they can require all unit owners to put in hurricane protection. So make that distinction. You distinguish between who's responsible for the maintenance. Is it the association or the unit owner? Association, no owner vote required. If it's a unit owner maintenance, then it takes a vote of the members. But then it's obligatory for all of the unit owners in the building. Oh, this is an interesting one. What if you have a master association and sub-associations, and an owner isn't paying either their assessments, and one or the other races to the courthouse with their lien and foreclosure? So they get the sub-associations ends up tied up with the unit. Up until now, they have to pay the master association's unpaid assessments. That law has changed. If either the master or a sub-association forecloses, they extinguish the obligation owed to the other association. You with me on that? Very important change in the law. You have a master association, you have sub-associations in a large community. The master association isn't being paid their assessments, the condo association isn't being paid their assessment, the master association files a lien, forecloses, When they foreclose, they name the sub-association and extinguishes the obligation owed to that condo association. Or vice versa. The neighborhood association forecloses, extinguishes the obligation owed to the master association. Do we recommend that approach? No. What I recommend is the two associations reach an agreement. We'll join forces, we'll file our liens, we'll foreclose, and we'll split the proceeds. A better approach, more neighborly, eliminates a lot of potential hassle. But that's now the law. The law now says you can extinguish your neighboring association's obligations if you file if you race to the courthouse and you get there first. I have to tell you something. This is the truth. When they were trying to cut back on their expenditures and flatten the paper somewhat, Florida Today had determined to discontinue the column I write. And they were flooded with calls from the Communities Associations Association. And I was really thrilled and honored and humbled by it. And they called me and said, please tell those people to stop calling or keep in your column. I had nothing to do with it, but I'm sure Roger did. And I really appreciate it. I want to wait till he finishes swallowing what he's about to eat, but I want to call up Senator Thad Altman, your state's senator, because there were some changes in the insurance provisions that were not covered in my speech, and I think I'd rather have a man who's involved in the writing of that law to explain to you how that insurance change has come to place. He's also, quite frankly, one of the real supporters of community association legislation. So, Senator Altman, I'd like to give you the mic.
Well, thank you, and it's a great honor. And Gary, what a great...
I'm going to use, I'm standing close. I got a mic on there for the pickup. Go ahead.
This has been very educational to me, being involved in the Homeowners Association myself, former condo association member. So this is very, very... And I commend all of you for your interest, because it's an incredible commitment. Believe me, I know. I've been a county commissioner, I've been a state rep and a senator. But my toughest elected job has been on the condo association, without a doubt, without a doubt. And I really wasn't involved in the writing. I was actually very involved in the opposition of some of the laws that we've passed related to homeowners association. And I know Florida Today has chronicled some of that. But we're very concerned about some of the changes. And Gary did mention some of the issues that may come up in the future. This replacement cost or full value cost. He communicated better than I could, but when you have damage, I believe in law in the past, we've had a law that required the insurance companies to provide full replacement cost coverage, not depreciated cost. And I fear, and they'll argue, well, you know, consumers should have a choice. You should be able to choose. Do you want to pay a higher premium for full replacement cost? Or you want to have a lower premium that will allow you to depreciate those costs? Well, that's a sham, because here's what's going to happen. The ability to find policies that will give you full replacement costs will then suddenly become more and more and more difficult, because policyholders will write those, or they'll start assessing such incredible fees and costs to have those policies that they won't become affordable. So by requiring the entire pool of insurance payers to, and the industry to provide that full replacement cost, because the reality is, you have an asset that has a value, and you place a value in that asset, and you choose to insure that. And that should be a basic standard, I think, in property insurance coverage, especially for real property and your possessions within that. We had some provisions, I know, Gary, you talked a little bit about that, having to replace things before you get reimbursed. And we amended a couple of these in terms of replacement costs. We were successful. Mike Fasano over in Pasco County, he's amazing. He's been in the Senate, I don't know how many years. He was former President Pro Tem. he has really taken a big leadership role in opposing some of these changes and tempering some of them. But they required you to submit invoices to replacement of items within your units prior to getting reimbursement. Let's think about that. You may have a 2% deductible in a hurricane. You have a major catastrophe. You're having to pay your deductible off to begin with, and now you're going to have to upfront monies prior to replacing those contents. It's crazy. And we were able to at least mitigate some of that impact, providing the consumer some protection. And then thirdly, and the one that we were not able to stop, is allowing underwriters to do an automatic 15% increase without getting the approval from the Office of Insurance Regulation. It's strictly an arbitrary number. I mean, we have the Office of Insurance Regulation for a reason, for a purpose, and that purpose is to actuarially rate policies. Why would legislators, politicians, with all the things on our, 2,000 bills a session, $70 billion budget, we are not actuarial scientists. We are not charged with actuarial rating all the policies that are written in the state of Florida. Why would we then allow insurance carriers to do a 15% rate adjustment without having to go through OIR? That's their job. That's a bad law. It's a bad provision. And it really needs to be undone. But so it was a tough year for consumers in insurance this year, a tough year. And there were some silver linings. We were able to moderate some of the changes that I think surprised the industry, because I felt that they kind of felt they had the votes to come in and change the whole series of laws. But it was a tough year. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. We certainly will continue to fight to protect the. And one more thing, just in closing, and why this is so wonderful with Space Coast Condo Associations. It's such an organized community. We need to step up. You know, we had a great loss when Bill Posey left the Senate. He's a great member. I'm happy to see him in Congress, but he chaired the insurance committee, and he was sort of a gatekeeper for us, being the chairman of that very, very important committee. But what we find is a situation in Florida where a lot of inland members of the legislature, a lot of inland residents, a lot of inland businesses, do not want to be a part of the same insurance pool as coastal communities. The coastal communities, they argue, well, you choose to live in a high-risk area, you should bear the total risk of that. Well, that's not right. That's wrong. We're one state. We all should share the same in commonality of risk, the same risk pool. Because about 70% of the wealth of this state, 70% of the wealth of the state is produced by coastal residents and coastal businesses. People choose to live near the coast. And we pay higher taxes for that. And those who live inland are really benefiting from educational, health care, transportation services because of we're footing that bill. So it's only fair that we share the common pool in the insurance world. And we know there's certain risks for living inland because you can get hit by both sides. In Haines City, I think I got hit by 3 hurricanes in the big busy year of hurricanes because they happened to cross from either side of the Gulf or the Atlantic. But I appreciate your involvement, and your leadership does a wonderful job. It's very important, not only for these condo association issues, for these issues that relate to insurance, issues that relate to specific needs that we have living in a coastal region, such as beach preservation and renourishment, and all the other things that affect our unique area. So keep it up. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Okay, I will take about the questions that were presented to me. And the first question, may an association give out owners' telephone numbers if they have obtained written consent? That reminded me of another practice that is very common in community associations, and that is, as a fundraiser, a lot of community associations have individuals come in and they say, we will publish a community phone book. And in that phone book, we will list the names of the owners, their addresses, their fax number, their email address and whatnot. You cannot do that any longer. Because unless an owner has given their consent to use their fax and telephone, their faxes and their email addresses as the address to receive notices of meetings, That is not official records and not open for inspection. But the owner can consent. So if you have written consent from the owners to give out their phone numbers or to put those in those books, then it would be permitted. Handicap parking, how many spaces are required? There was a very interesting case I spoke about at a national conference very recently called Gitteman. Now, what made the Gitteman case of interest involved the Homeowner Association, where the document sets expressly that all parking was part of the common areas and to be used on a first-come, first-served basis, and it expressly said that that the association could not assign exclusive use of parking to any unit owner. An individual who was clearly a handicapped individual petitioned the association to amend the documents to permit express assignments and or absent an amendment to give them a parking space close to their home. The association put the vote to the membership. The membership voted down the amendment. The individual sued as a violation of fair housing, failure to make a reasonable accommodation in the rules and regulations, and the unit owner won the case. What the court ruled, and there was another ruling just recently on this, is the federal law, as it relates to fair housing law, takes precedent. Remember I said before where we said that no state can impair? It's a classic case where the federal government can impair. And the court ruled that you cannot hide behind the cloak of your local documents to preclude you from complying with a federal mandate, in this case, to make accommodations for handicapped persons and provide them where they need it, parking spaces that are closer to their units. So the one thing the court said in a case that, in this case, is that there's nothing in the federal law that defines how many handicapped parking spaces there need to be. They said that that's not the issue. The issue isn't handicapped parking spaces, how many, but whether or not you're making a reasonable accommodation to the owner to provide them, if they have a need, a handicapped parking space. Our property manager told us our association that had a unit in foreclosure for over 3 years and the foreclosure case was dismissed by the judge. Can this occur? It is occurring. And the reason it's occurring is one of the reasons, I don't know why this one was, is that the judge determines that the foreclosing bank, if it was a bank, or the association, lacks the evidence to prove that the note and mortgage were in fact that executed by the individual and that they have the original documents. A lot of those original notes and mortgages cannot be found. You remember the days, you know, that you would go out, you would borrow money from a local bank, they serviced the mortgage, and you'd go in, they knew you by name. Those days are long gone. When banks give the mortgage today, they bundle them and they sell them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Probably the worst concept that was ever created. Then you have another agency of government called FHA. They insure what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buy. That's what caused the entire downturn of the market with the subprime loans. And now Fannie Mae comes out with a new guidelines where they say we're no longer going to give spot approval of mortgages. That's disastrous for your communities. What does that mean? It means that if you have a vacant unit, you have an individual who comes in and buys, the individual is financially solvent, they have the ability to buy the unit, they have the ability to pay your assessments, and the bank turns to FHA because they're not going to keep the loan and says, will you insure this loan? And they say, well, does it meet this criteria? The criteria is that the association has no more than 10% of the units in deficient. They have reserves at the level where you require reserves, and then there's a whole list of other criteria. Then they say, we will or will not approve the loan based upon the financial condition of the community itself, not the individual. So there are reasons that banks have, in fact, dismissed foreclosure actions. I didn't talk about this one. I have I have to. It raises a flag. This is disastrous. I wrote about this on my blog. I do a blog every week, every Thursday in the Sun Sentinel. You just go online, and it's in this blog talked about a case that I think is very dangerous. There was a case called Abbey Park decided in the early 1980s that said that the obligation of a unit owner to pay their share of the common expenses and the duty of the association to maintain the condominium property, this applies to the homeowner association as well, are independent covenants. What that means is you cannot say as an excuse for not paying your assessment, I don't like the way the board runs the association, I don't like the way they maintain the landscaping, I don't like the way they keep up the building. Because it's a self-defeating prophecy. What if every unit owner said we're not paying our assessments because of one of those excuses? Well, a court recently ruled, within the last 2 weeks, that an individual could plead as a defense to paying their assessment offset of money they claim the association owes them for damage caused by a water leak in their unit. I think this could be a horrendous result. I mean, we're having enough problems as they are, and now you have this Court of Appeals saying that when the owner stops paying and you demand payment, you file a lien, you foreclose, they can use as a defense to non-payment that there was damage to their unit which the association hasn't paid for. So that's something that you really need, that I'm really concerned about. To establish a quorum for our annual meeting, should a notice meeting or within a board meeting delete suggested voting rights for delinquent owners or foreclosures? Reminds me of something. All these things remind me. You may not publish, lists. Deadbeat lists. Thank you. You may not publish deadbeat lists. Okay, it's a violation of the Federal Fair Debt Practice Collections Act. You cannot take a list and put it up on your lobby of those owners who are not paying. The penalties are severe in that, okay? We're going to have to hold the questions because I got to leave soon. I've got to drive all the way back down to South Florida. But as far as the... the quorum... As I said, if you have a unit owner whose voting rights have been suspended for non-payment, then it does affect a quorum. I've answered that question. It says you do not count them in your quorum.
How do you get them off of your quorum?
They're automatically suspended. If they've lost their voting right, they do not count. They can't vote, and you don't even have to send them a letter. I mean, the bottom line is if they're delinquent, you've suspended their voting right. If I'd use the example of a unit, a condominium of 50 units, 45 of them are loss of voting rights for delinquency. The number for quorum purposes is 45, and then you take a majority of 45. Okay? What are the legal reasons for disapproving of a lease in a condominium? First of all, and I'll start off with this because obviously we don't see many lawsuits with this. It definitely cannot be for one of the protected class discriminatory reasons. What are the protected classes? Race, religion, sex, national origin, handicap, and familial status. By the way, age is not a protected class. What's a protected class is familial status. That is a individual below the age of 18 residing with a parent or guardian. But that could be exempted out, assuming that the community qualifies as a community for older persons. Generally speaking, what the courts have said is that the approval process is a bifurcated process. That means it's divided into two parts. Part number one is that the application has to, on its face, they said, facially comply with covenants, conditions, and restrictions. What that means is, let's assume you look at an application, and it says that the applicant who wants to lease the unit is a family of five people, and they want to rent a one-bedroom unit that only allows two people per bedroom. Without the association exercising any of its obligation to lease the unit, the association could reject the applicant. I also believe you can reject applications to purchase if you establish guidelines of financial worthiness, that is, the financial ability of an individual to meet the qualifications of a unit owner. But to do that, you have to establish those guidelines, you have to apply them equally across the board, and again, they can't be based upon any of the protected class issues. That's generally what happens. You end up with a guideline on financial worthiness, and then someone immediately goes to HUD and says, wait a minute, this is being done for discriminatory purposes. So you always have to, in all your rules, apply them equally to every single person. If you have that type of guideline, and Donald Trump comes to your building to buy a unit or to lease a unit, you can't say, well, it's Donald Trump, we're not going to make him go through the screening process or show his qualifications. That's the way you would lose your ability to enforce your covenants. They apply equally to your mother, your father, your cousins. They apply equally, no discriminatory action when you're looking at those leasing interviews. Even you can do it for, I'm going to say it wrong, what's it called, Skypes?
Skype.
You can even do it with Skype now, which is over the computer. You can do interviews. You can do them by phone. You can do them by letter. Okay, one of the last questions. Even I'm losing my breath, my voice. If a special... So I'm going to, for a specific, what is this word? If the special.
Committee.
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't read the. If a special committee is appointed for a specific work of investigating a potential renter's meets to discuss personal information, background credit, does the meeting have to be open so as to or personal information? You know, that's a good question. Meetings of, let's put it this way, the statute says that information gathered for screening of potential buyers and sellers is not a part of the official record. That's the law. Information gathered is part of the official records for screening of individuals is not part of the official records. I construe that to mean that, and doesn't say in the statute, that the meeting at which that information is gathered can be closed to the public. Okay? I've enjoyed being here with you. Have a great weekend. I'm going to turn the mic back over to Roger.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Senator Dan Walton for stopping in. And also Commissioner Infantini. And if you, this has all been recorded. It's all going to be on DVDs. The DVDs will be available. They're $20. You can send me an email or mail a check to the post office box for $20 with all your information in it, and these DVDs will be mailed directly to you. Okay, we have a board meeting immediately following. And we have room for about six guests if anybody'd like to come. Now, just be advised that our next association meeting will be September 24th, and it'll be on budgets with a large amount of Q&A. So bring your questions. Okay? And the programs that will be put together for next year will be posted on the website probably as of the end of this month. I'm being flagged for a second. Hang on. Oh, we need to get Senator Altman on video. Senator, welcome to Space Coast 2011 June meeting. If you need any more information regarding almost anything, it's all available on the website, and you can get there via scca-online.org. And thank you all for coming. I hope it was as informative for you as it was for me. Have a great weekend. And see you all in September.